second, seems like annual, interdisciplinary workshop on security and human behavior. For those who were here last year, welcome back. This is likely to be as much fun as it was last year. And those who are the first year, welcome, and you get to figure out how much fun this is going to be. I'm going to do a couple of admin announcements. Lunches will be here right outside. Technically, no food is allowed in this room. Operationally, please be careful. For lunches, we'd really prefer if you'd sit out on those tables out there and eat. You know, for breaks, just be careful. Dinner will be tonight at Legal Seafoods, which is where we were last year. And I believe we're going to have free beer, charge for wine, and actually give you money back if you order a soft drink. Actually not.
I'm sorry, that's not complicated enough.
I have one Coke in my mind.
Alright. Yeah. Actually, well, all beer and wine and drinks will be included. Bathrooms are down that way, across from the Forbes cafeteria. If there's a fire, just act rationally. And that's all the announcements I have to make. Ross.
Okay, three announcements I have to make. Firstly, we changed the program slightly since you last saw it to accommodate various people's attendance, non-attendance, planes, blah, 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 blah. That's online at the usual place. There will also be paper programs distributed at the morning break. Second, as with last year, Matt will be recording the proceedings, and the recording will eventually go up on his blog. If you don't want your comments to be recorded, then it's up to you to opt out. We've all read Nudge. We all think that the openness is a good thing, so this appears to be the behavioral economics approach to publicising the workshop. And finally, on time, we're asking the session chairs to please be strict on time. We'd like all speakers to stay within 10 minutes, because one of the things that made this work so well last year, and we hope will make it work again this year, is keep it maximally interactive, which means that we want at least half an hour in each panel session for interactive discussion. So the chair for this first session is Dave Clark from MIT. Dave.
Good morning. On behalf of MIT, I'd like to welcome you. Bruce already gave all the relevant announcements, which is if you ever drop food on the floor here, I'll never be able to reserve this room again. So please be respectful in whatever manner you choose to the instruction that no food or drink is permitted in here. And if following his instructions you can't find the bathroom, we'll send out a guide. The first floor of this building, like all the floors of this building, is topologically complex. For those of you who've ever been at MIT, you will know that there's all the buildings on the center of MIT are connected by something called the Infinite Corridor, which is a long straight corridor. People love to do things like, you know, come out at 2 o'clock in the morning and shoot cross posts down it. And when Geary was designing a building, he said, oh, that's really cool, I want a corridor too, but he's never done anything straight in his life. So we get this thing out here called Student Street. I'm under strict instructions to keep this session to 10 minutes apiece, and that includes your laptop setup time. Although we are dealing with the fact that the machine that was provided for us over there appears to require a password, which nobody bothered to give us. So with the exception of that little problem, you are on the hook for the time, including your laptop setup time. We're going to just follow the agenda as it's listed, which means that our first speaker is Mark Frank. And the tradition we have here, of course, is we don't introduce people because their job is to introduce themselves. So I'm going to stand up at 9 minutes. I'm going to give you the hook at 10. And may we proceed?
I don't think Mark...
So we're missing Mark Frank. That chair is empty.
I haven't seen
it. Kind of a light session. Yeah. 4 or 6.
David?
Where's Frank?
Oh, okay.
How about, can we do you?
Well,
are you having
I would prefer to be able to plug this in.
Hold on a moment.
But if that is impossible, I'll wing it.
Mr. Sion, are you in a position to talk because you have a laptop?
Well, if you want, yeah, okay.
Well, you're already plugged in. That's the only reason
all
I was...
Right.
You're the only one who's actually...
Right.
Let's see if this is talking to us.
Right. Okay. The fourth speaker of the session. Frank, yeah. Thank you for being flexible.
Hello. So I can't operate this from my chair. So I'll have to.
Well,
it would go over the 10 minutes if I also actually plugged in a remote control and so on. So let's just get on with this as we are. So this talk is a result of cooperation with someone in a slightly different business from me, Paul Wilson, who is not an academic and who does the wonderful job of researching and documenting real-time, real-life scams and hustles and then film them with hidden cameras for a successful TV documentary in Britain called The Real Hustle. So the problem I'm facing here is that if I look at what we security engineers are too often guilty of doing, is that we fix security problems according to what we consider is the logical solution. However, real system users don't follow the same logic that we believe is what regulates the world, and reality wins, and therefore we fail to protect these users that we profess being our job to protect. So who really understands what users do? Those who do understand what users really do are the fraudsters. They make it their business to study human psychology very carefully in a non-academic but nevertheless very effective way, and they exploit all the flaws that they see in very effective fashions. So the message of this brief talk is that we should use the same insights as the hustlers have to understand what the flaws in the human behavior patterns are, and then use them to improve system security. So if technology doesn't fail me, I shall now hand over to my absent co-author by this video.
Our three hustlers have come to the seaside to perform the Monte scam for our concealed cameras and to teach us the tricks behind this classic con. Even though the Monte is illegal, it is still played by hustlers all over the UK today. Our team have engaged the services of some local hustlers to help them out. They'll all be looking for a wealthy target, known as the Mark, to play the game. This passerby seems interested. He's their man. He's the Mark. Unknown to him, everyone else playing the game is in on it.
Point you went to nothing. No, you won't bet that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you pull it on this one?
No.
You want that one? Ladies first. Here we go.
It looks to our Mark like Jess has just won some money. But remember, she's in on it like everybody else. Jess is using her feminine charms to win over the Mark and convince him to bet with her money.
Loser, you got some money? Anyone else got some money? Yeah,
you're bet. Great, our Mark is going to play with Jess's money.
Hang on. She's helping you out.
With Jess's help, the Mark is now a winner.
Shall I get to your girlfriend? Next bet. You got some money on you. If you don't stay, you're gonna have to pay. You got some money?
Come on. 50.
I'll take a 50.
Alex and Jess have hooked him in, and now he's gonna play with his own money, £50.
Ready? You ready? I'm gonna do it nice and slow. Keep your eye on the middle one, yeah? That's all you're gonna keep your eye on. That one there. Because that one's, that's a loser, right? This one, that's a loser, right?
Now it's time for Paul's part in the scam. While Alex turns away to cough, Paul switches two of the discs, apparently moving the spotted disc back to the middle. Our Mark thinks Paul is trying to trick Alex, but in fact, it's all part of the bigger scam to convince the Mark to bet. And it works perfectly. Everybody else joins in and bets as well, so our Mark won't feel so bad when he loses.
Half of you are right, that's okay. But all of you are wrong. Points! Thank you.
Demonstration of a classic scam, and I mean, there's a paper that we are writing that is available from the SHUB page, which you're welcome to read on and comment on. And the way I've structured this is I was going to show a few of these scans. Now, with 10 minutes, I'm probably going to be able to do just one, maybe one more, if possible. But then after that, trying to extract some lessons learned from these scans that we have distilled into a series of principles that say, okay, these are things that recur in those hassles and that are evidence of weaknesses in the defenses of humans with respect to fraud that can be relevant to systems defense as well as just individual scans. So one fundamental thing is this distraction principle, that while the marks are distracted with what retains their interest, then anything else can happen and they will not pay attention. And for example, in the Monty, as in any kind of sleight of hand or magic tricks, there's always some element of distraction. Look here, and I'm doing something over there. But also at a higher level, there's the fact that while the guy is riveted to what's happening with those discs, then some accomplices are pickpocketing any of the guys that are either playing or just looking on. And this applies to a number of situations. The social compliance principle, this is one where society trains people not to question authority. So I'm going to show another one that is an excellent example of that. And maybe this has given the game away slightly, but you will still enjoy, I'm sure.
The hustlers have selected a small high street jeweler's as the perfect place to stage this scam. Unbeknown to the shop staff, our hidden cameras have been placed inside to cover the following action. Jess enters the shop first, looking well dressed and respectable.
Hi, hi. Oh, necklace.
She approaches the counter and talks to the staff about wanting to buy a new necklace.
Silver.
Alex comes into the shop shortly after. He is apparently just another browsing shopper. And where's the third member of our team? Paul is outside ready to step in on cue.
Nice one here.
After some browsing, they show Jess a necklace that takes her fancy.
Yeah, that's the sort of length. Yeah. How much is this one? It's quite a small one. 600. Yeah, that's really.
The necklace is worth around £600, which is a suitable bit of swag for this scam. Jess seems happy with the choice and says she'll buy it. As she finishes counting the notes, Alex swoops in.
Hey, stop there, police.
What?
Wasn't the police. Tracy, I'm placing you under arrest for deception and fraud. Leave that money in the counter. Please let my colleague in, please.
Flashing a fake police badge, he arrests Jess for passing counterfeit money. Will the shopkeepers buy his act?
We've been following her all day. There's been counterfeit cash. She's been passing it off for jewellers.
Minute 30.
Yeah, go ahead.
The shocked shopkeepers have bought his line and the hook and sinker too. The hustlers insist the cash is forged and must be backed as evidence. In fact, it's the gang's own hustle bankroll and it's actually not forged at all.
We'll go in for evidence for her. I'm afraid that's part of the evidence as well now. You will get it back.
And there it is. Alex, the fake copper, has convinced the shopkeeper to bag up a £600 necklace as well.
Right. There's a number of things that we extract out of this. The police tells you to do something, then you do that. And your bank tells you to do something, and you do that. And it's dangerous to train people to respond to this acritically because that's the way that all phishing works, for example. That's the way that all social engineering works. There's a wonderful quote from David Mitnick who said, I can phone into a police station and ask them to consult the police database for me, and it works even better with the police because they have this respect for hierarchy. If I say that I'm a sergeant or a lieutenant, then they're going to bow to me and do anything I say, so long as I have the right catchphrases to open the thing. And I'm afraid I've only been given another 30 seconds, so I won't be able to go through all these principles, but I'd be really keen to discuss all this with people from the psychology side and be educated about what they should really be called. Thank you.
So we had an order for this session, but it's disrupted both by the absence of speakers and by the fact that I can't log into the laptop that was loaned to us for this session because. It gives me two options, neither of which works. So I'm fishing for anybody.
I'm having to go next, and I have no slides.
That's great. That's what I was hoping for. I
will stall for the rest of you. I actually have probably...
You're okay with that.
Yeah, we can go without
slides. We're okay as well, so...
Okay.
We're all prepared to ring it.
Well, we can try to take it in the nominal order, which I think, given that there's an empty seat down there, maybe means David is on next.
Okay.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. In fact, it's probably best that I don't use this. As a philosopher, I like things neat and tidy and precise, and that can sometimes detract from the message. Because I guess what's important here is to paint things in rather large, broad brushstrokes, and folks who are interested, we can have dialogues afterwards on other occasions. So I trust you will warn me when I have 3 minutes or so. 2 minutes?
Three?
Okay. Give me three so I can wind down. Philosophers tend to talk too much. Philosophers tend to start investigations by asking the following question. What are we talking about? A question that goes back to Socrates. And so if a philosopher is interested in...
You are about to take my microphone.
Oh. Okay.
It's stuck to your shoe.
Okay. And it's wrapped around my leg. This will go well. Okay. So where was I? Oh, yes. So we ask what we're talking about. And we try to develop some reasonably clear idea of what we're talking about. So philosophers interested in deception, like I am, want to ask the question, well, what do we mean by this word deception? Now, when we ask what we mean, we can take that in a couple of ways, too. A lot of what has interested philosophers in the past are what are called descriptive definitions. And descriptive definition is basically what the necessary and sufficient conditions that people tend to use when they're applying a term. A descriptive definition is supposed to include only the set of things to which the term properly applies. Unfortunately, our ordinary use of terminology is very fuzzy and very imprecise and very eccentric. So this is typical. It's doomed to failure, in my opinion. I don't know of any cases outside of formal stipulative definitions where you have really workable, necessary, and sufficient conditions. What philosophers of a naturalistic streak are more interested in are what are the theoretical definitions. Now, the definition of theoretical definition is a little bit controversial, but take it to mean basically that something that which something has to have to fall under a term. Right? So we're not interested in the markers that people use when they're deploying terms. We're interested in what something has to have, its essence, as it were. So an example of a theoretical definition would be gold is the element with atomic number 79. You take a paradigmatic sample, you figure out what makes the thing that it is, and then you generalize that. Rather than using something like, well, the definition of gold is a shiny, heavy, malleable yellow metal. So what about deception? Well, deception has proven extraordinarily difficult to define properly. Let me run through a few traditional attempts, and then I'll tell you what I think is fundamentally wrong with the attitude, and then offer, with a little bit of theoretical elaboration, an alternative to them. So you could go to the Oxford Dictionary, which defines deception as cause to have a false belief. That's grossly inadequate as a definition. Suppose I were to say to you, suppose I were to send you an email, and I intend to say, I will not be at your birthday party, and I miss the word not. So it says, I'll be at your birthday party. Well, I cause you to have a false belief, but we wouldn't want to count that as an instance of deception. It's misleading, but it's not deception. So we could try something more, and we could say to deceive is to intentionally cause someone to have a false belief. Well, that still doesn't work. Suppose I sincerely believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and I convince you to accept this proposition. Well, it's something here we have an example of a false belief that I intentionally cause you to accept, but it still shouldn't count as deception. Well, how about intentionally causing someone to have a false belief that the speaker knows to be false? That still isn't good enough, and I could give you an elaborate science fiction-y sort of scenario, the sort that philosophers love to invent to show you why that is, but I don't want to spend the time on doing that. I want to go to a more fundamental difficulty, which is this is an anthropocentric definition. We know that other sorts of systems, apart from human beings, engage in deceptions. We know this from behavioral ecology. We know this from physiology. So certainly in the biological realm, we know that many non-human organisms deceive, and in fact, quite primitive organisms deceive, and even suborganismic biological systems deceive. A splendid example of that is the human placenta, which to prevent itself from getting ejected. The placenta is technically a neuroendocrine parasite. It's built out of paternal genes, so it's got to protect itself from the mother's body, who wants to get rid of this parasite. And so what it does is it coats itself in a chemical coating that makes it invisible to the mother's immune system. Precisely the same technique that parasitic nematode worms use when they're invading their hosts. If we look at other organisms, we find deception is rampant in nature, and it's rampant in nature because it works. It gives organisms an edge in the struggle, what Darwin called the struggle for existence. It helps organisms find mates, it helps organisms find food, it helps organisms to catch prey, it helps them to evade predation. So obviously, if we want a perfectly general theoretical definition of deception, we can't base it on the human case. If we're going to invoke distinctive aspects of human deception in it, which would exclude these other instances of deception. So I think strategically it's a really good policy to take an example of deception in a very simple organism, and with the idea that this will give us the most general notion of what's involved in deception, and extract a theoretical definition from that. The example I'd like to share with you briefly is my favorite example, what I call my paradigmatic example, which is the way that the mirror orchid deceives it's the pollinating species of wasp for it. And it does this by simulating the, using both chemical and morphological signals. It simulates the female of the species of wasp that pollinates it. So basically what the orchid does is produces the flower, and I have on my slides some beautiful pictures of this, which look remarkably like a female wasp, and if you're a male wasp, smell like the female wasp. And these flowers are produced before the females of this species sexually mature. There's a time lag between when the males mature and the females mature. And what the wasp does then, it's all these males are flying around, they see the flowers, there are no females around, they go for the, in effect, wasp pornography that the plant produces. And what the flower does then, it causes the wasp to linger on the flower, pick up lots of pollen, and fly off. Now, there's kind of a disjunct between that sort of example and human examples, which is we've already established from the first definitions that we want deception to be purposive. Non-purposive activities don't seem to fall under the heading of deception. So what we require is a broader notion of purposiveness, which doesn't entail intended in the narrow human sense. And we have that. There are good analyses of biological purpose such that the features of the flower have a purpose. So what we want then, to make a long story
actually deceptively sure, is something like this. To deceive is, I had it all technical on my slides here. Right, so when A deceives B, what's going on is there's some feature of A that has the biological purpose set down ultimately by evolution, modified by learning, to cause some mechanism in the target organism to fail to fulfill its biological purpose in such a way as its failing allows some other feature of the deceiving organism to fulfill its purpose. And I think what we have there is something approaching a perfectly general theoretical definition of deception. I'm assuming my time is up at this point.
Your time is, you have 6 seconds.
Oh, 6 seconds. So, how do you like that?
Impressive timing.
There's a very long video cable. Are there is?
If it's me next, which I think it is, I have my computer here. I just need a DGI PGA adapter.
The what?
An adapter.
I'm going to plug it in with that, sir.
Brilliant, thank you.
Provided your Mac is at least a year and a half old.
About that. That looks good.
If you need the new one, I have a new one. Just
okay,
you got there.
This is an enormously long cable, so it could actually sit in. You could sit there if you wanted.
Okay, let's go. Thank you very much.
As your nuts on the car.
Bad audio and a bad.
Take the cable that you've got.
Okay.
Do you want me to talk?
And we switched from the original.
David,
let me
go while they fiddle.
Okay.
All right. So we'll do Bruce next.
So I'm gonna stall while they fiddle. Actually, I have three short things.
So Bruce, the mic's over there. Just so you know.
Okay. So. I have three short things I want to talk about in relation to security and human behavior and psychology. And the first is how we buy security. Now, fundamentally, there are two reasons we want things, either fear or greed. Either we want the thing because we want it, or we want it the thing because we want to avoid what would happen if we don't have it. And we know from behavioral economics that people tend to be risk-averse when it comes to gains and risk-seeking when it comes to losses. So for gains, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And for losses, there isn't actually a quaint phrase that I found. But we tend to be willing to take the big risk rather than accept the small loss. This has actually effects on selling security. You know, normally, when you go to a computer conference, or sort of any conference where vendors are selling, they're selling stuff based on features, based on things you want. You want to buy the word processor, the database, whatever the product is. When it comes to security, you're buying it, you're selling it based on what people don't want. You're selling it based on fear. And customers are more likely to look at the security product or service and say, well, I might as well take the chance. Right, I mean, you know, I didn't have it last year, it turned out okay. There isn't the greed sell. You see this, interestingly enough, in a lot of the slogans that security companies have. There's a lot of attempts to turn the fear sell into a greed sell. So you see things like return on investment models, which are attempts to shoehorn security into something that'll actually help you make more money. Or slogans, I think Symantec had this several years ago, we concentrate on security so you can focus on your business. Okay. And it's again an attempt to turn fear into a greed sell. These actually seem not to work, that fundamentally security is a fear sell. When fear sells do work is when people are actually really scared. You talk to someone who sells burglar alarms and they'll say, no one will buy one unless A, you know, they've been robbed, or B, their neighbor's been robbed. That something has happened to them psychologically that makes them scared. And you could look at September 11th, that something happened to our nation, epidemics, something psychologists call flashbulb events, things that will change the way people think and make them scared. The thing that's happening now in the security field, which is changing this, is that security is becoming embedded into other products. So like an automobile, where safety features are not sold separately but are built in, security becomes part of a greater greed sell. Now, it's still marketed. I mean, Saab marketed itself on safety for many years. Airbags are sold as a feature for cars. But it's still embedded in the greater greed sell. And I think that's going to be a profound change on how security is sold, how computer security is sold. I think it's sort of interesting to watch that. The second thing I want to mention, second two will be a little shorter, is Conficker. For those who are not computer security people, Conficker is this sort of big, massive internet worm that has spent many months infecting millions of computers worldwide. And it had a date attached to it. On April 1st, it was going to phone home. And this was very much a news event. That April 1st was going to be the day that Conficker was going to take over the internet. And sort of, and I mean, the stories were like that. And since it's now early June and none of you remember this, you'll realize that Conficker actually didn't take over the internet, and it didn't take over the world. And when you looked at the actual details of the worm, the April Fool's date actually wasn't much of anything. It wasn't that the worm had several mechanisms to basically phone home and update itself. Modern worms are adaptable. So they always have to adapt to the defenses, antivirus software, and you know, updates in the operating system. And Conficker had several ways to phone home, one of which triggered on April 1st, which it did, and nothing happened. And then like a week later, during some other mechanism it had to phone home, it updated itself. And it's sort of interesting to see that for computer security, for everybody, that dates, that singular events, matter much more than the broad threats. Nobody actually noticed when it did phone home and update itself. But the April 1st date was a date. It was something the news media can peg a story around. And it was a big deal. And I see some similarities between us in the United States being willing to accept 42,000 automobile deaths every year, but 400 deaths in an airplane crash is a disaster. That these singular events really cause us to confuse what the threat is. That's the second story I want to tell. The third one is about science fiction writers. I don't know if you know this, but the US government hires science fiction writers to come into DHS and to tell them what the threats are. Right? The idea was that 9/11 was a failure of imagination, and who has better imagination than science fiction writers? So let's make sure that failure never happens again. Well, there are actually some interesting mechanisms that take place here. And this is based on some research done pull up the paper so I'll get the country, in a Scandinavian country, I think Norway, which looked at people doing risk analysis for software projects and found that people who did those risk analyses didn't actually have a better handle on what the risks were. That in fact they got the risk wrong more, and they were overconfident about their results. And the mechanisms that seem to be in place, are the control bias, that because people did more risk analysis, they thought they were more in control of the risks than they actually were. There was the familiarity bias, that because they thought about them, they're more familiar with them. And the availability heuristic, that as people thought about risks in software projects, the ones that were remote, they didn't have to worry about, happened near the end. So they were more available. And then when they calculated their overall risk, they tended to rate it lower. And the third explanation they gave is similar, the peak-end rule, that the end experience tends to be substitute for the whole experience. And these same things seem to come into effect when you ask science fiction writers to think about the next terrorism risks. You have the control bias, that the risks you'll get out of science fiction writers are much less under your control. So you tend to think that the risk is less under your control. The last risks you get tend to be the more outlandish ones, the scarier ones, and so the availability heuristic kicks in, and those are the ones you remember, and also the peak end rule kicks in. So it seems like if you hire science fiction writers to think about your risks, you will feel less in control and that the risks are greater than they actually are. And I think this is something we've seen. I mean, as even in the sort of popular media, as the risks we wrote about got weirder, scuba divers or attacking the food supply, as we would hear about them again and again, we tended to over-magnify what the overall risk is. So those are the three things I wanted to talk about. Have you guys solved your computer problems yet? You're supposed to say yes.
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 That's for.
I'm sorry.
For the paper.
Actually, the paper, the third paper just talked about. It's going to be a Wired article in about a week.
Okay.
So it'll be the my article and then the paper link will be on my blog in about a week. I should tell you that. Jurgensen. I don't know what university he's from, but it has an O with a slash through it, which implies Nordic.
Not Swedish.
Okay. So people who know more than I do. Sorgensen.
Sorgensen. Danish.
Danish? Okay. No Danishes in this room.
Danishes.
So we're gonna continue with the theory that we'll do the talks back to back and then we'll have some discussion. And we're hoping that we've maybe got the fuss factor under my control, under somebody's control. I see slides. I see a speaker. I see a speaker prepared to talk to the slides. Let's try it.
Okay, thanks. So the only problem is it's sort of over to the right. I don't know why that is. Anyway, my name is Dominic Johnson. I'm from the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Edinburgh. I want to talk today about paradigm shifts in security strategy, and also to mention this is part of a larger project about which you'll hear much more tomorrow from Terry Taylor, who's sitting at the back. So the thing on the left is a book which came out of a project called Natural Security. The subtitle is A Darwinian Approach to a Dangerous World. The two people featured are the editors, Rafe Sagarin, who's a marine biologist currently at Duke, and Terry Taylor, who I mentioned, who you'll hear more about tomorrow. We got together three times in Santa Barbara at something called the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis to discuss the possibility that nature may hold lessons for understanding our own human security threats, much as we heard about before. Perhaps a classic example is engineering innovations taken from nature. This is a new design for a wind turbine taken from a humpback whale fin. Apparently, these sort of serrations give you more power and less noise. We hear about those sort of engineering examples a lot. The idea of the working group was to take a much broader view and just think about the entirety of the 3.5 billion years of life on Earth, which is just full of countless examples of security problems, if you like. How to deal with competition, predation, parasites, resources, external factors like climate and climate change and weather patterns and so on. All of these things are security threats in many senses of the word, which all sorts of organisms have to deal with. We have the whole fossil record to look at. We also have 100 million species or so today. So the idea was to sort of put these many approaches derived from biology and evolution under this sort of one framework. And these are some of the examples of the things we're interested in. So biomimicry is like the humpback whale example, but also ecology, paleontology, which types of adaptations have managed to persevere even through the mass extinctions? What classes of security adaptations seem to work best over the long term? We heard a bit about animal behavior. Evolutionary psychology is another big one. But also things like immunology. How does the human immune system work? If the DHS worked like our human immune system, we'd have much less problems than we do. And so on. I'm going to talk more about adaptation today. So there's many people involved, many projects. I'm just going to talk about one now, which is what I call paradigm shift in security strategies. So I think there's a puzzle. If you look at what happened in 9/11, the striking thing to me is not that there was a sort of failure of policy or intelligence. The striking thing was that the threat was pretty clearly recognized and not very much was done to prepare for it. So Covid Black, who's a terrorism expert, George Tenet, CIA director at the time, claimed that the only thing they didn't do when trying to convince Condi Rice of the threat was pull the trigger of the gun they were holding to her head. So at least according to them, this threat was tangible and nothing really was done to deal with it. I think this is not an isolated, unique event. You find very similar things if you look at what happened up to Pearl Harbor and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Very similar sorts of dynamics in the build-up to the event. People knew things were wrong and there was no real tangible effort to change or adapt. Ideally, of course, when we're faced with novel security threats, we'd gradually adapt over time, right? So that we keep pace with it. But it seems to be, at least with these anecdotes, that there is slow or little adaptation over time. And adaptation comes very suddenly after you've already experienced the disaster, after you've had a lot of deaths or a lot of expensive damage. And looking a little bit into this, it seems that this is perhaps no surprise. There's a broader pattern of failure to adapt to risks, and also a sort of interesting cross-domain phenomenon whereby things change very slowly over time, but then you have sudden turning points when something critical happens. So you've got Kuhn's paradigm shifts in the history of science, Foucault's so-called moments of rupture in history where systems of knowledge are suddenly overturned, and then punctuated equilibrium we'll know from evolution, but this is actually used as a model to explain US policy dynamics by guys called Baumgartner and Jones. And then, of course, in economics, you have this saying that it only really progresses with each funeral. So, I mean, they're very different, but it suggests that there's something common about human nature or the nature of the institutions we create that sort of set themselves up for failure. So just to be clear, the hypothesis is that adaptation to novel security threats only really occurs after disasters happen. So we have some very simplistic predictions if we want to sort of try and find out whether this is plausible. Policy changes should follow disasters. Disasters are going to be unexpected because they haven't been predicted. And victims are going to be unprepared because they haven't planned. So in order to sort of test that idea, you'd need an unbiased selection of cases. Pearl Harbor, Cuban Missile Crisis, 9/11, perhaps they're just sort of picked out of a hat because they fit the data or fit the idea. But I got these so-called policy watersheds since 1945 from an independent US Air Force War College report, which were events they decided were the key turning points in security strategies in World War II. Now, you can't read that, so the point here is down the left-hand side, there's seven or eight key turning points in security strategy. And in every single case, it was completely unexpected. They hadn't prepared for this event to happen. And then after it had happened, there was significant changes. So as one example, JFK's defense buildup from 61 to 63 was really triggered by the Berlin and Cuban missile crises. They were completely unexpected. They were worried that something might happen, but US deterrence policy actually failed. But after the event, having experienced the disaster, all of these chain of events happened to adapt US security policy to what was eventually seen as a novel security threat. So I think a lot more work would need to be done to sort of show this is broadly true, but I think there's something going on there. So the next question is why? So what are the causes? And unfortunately, because this is a sort of, if you like, exploratory piece of work, it's a chapter in the book, there's a laundry list of ideas here, but I mean, you get the general idea. There's sensory biases. If we don't experience something ourselves, then we're less likely to be actually moved to do something about it. If you try and tell someone about a hypothetical threat, you're not actually going to engage their evolved sensory mechanisms, and they're not going to get so excited about it. A whole host of psychological biases is my particular interest. For example, cognitive dissonance, matching your prior beliefs, whatever you believe in the past, is going to be reinforced by new events, give or take some variation. and then other aspects of organizations and leadership and electoral politics in particular. I think perhaps just to take another example at the end, if you think about trying to convince the public of a hypothetical, invisible, future abstract terrorist threat, which is only really a threat if you're privy to the secret information that the President and the National Security Council have, how are you going to convince the public to support adaptation towards that threat? How are you going to convince Congress to give you millions of pounds to deal with it? It's very difficult to do. So there seem to be a whole host of biases which converge on preserving the status quo, set us up for disaster. How much time do I have? Not much. I was going to give you a couple of examples.
10 minutes and 2 seconds.
Okay. About overconfidence and percentage of success. Just one thing, okay. How do Americans perceive whether we are winning the war on terror or not? Okay, this is a polling question asked many times since fall of 2001. Who's winning the war on terror? Black line is the US, grey line is the terrorists. Some of the other things. The important point here is that it doesn't seem that people measure politics as success by what's actually happening on the ground. They're buffeted around by big salient events, which often have nothing to do with the war on terror. So people's belief that the US is winning the war on terror jumps after 9/11. And then it jumps again at the invasion of Iraq, okay, which obviously has nothing to do with the war on terror. When does it jump again? When they capture Saddam Hussein. And then the only other peak right towards the end is when al-Zarqawi was killed in Iraq. Maybe that's relevant, but the point of this is to show that, at least among the public, perceptions of success seem to be much more to do with salient events, big dramatic and newsworthy stories, than gradual progress on the ground. So I gave you this sort of laundry list of why we might be cursed with this sort of setting ourselves up for disaster. But I think the key thing is that the failures are not random. We've tried to sort of create a taxonomy of common biases which lead to this status quo bias. They all seem to stem from human social behaviour, social interactions. They have systematic causes and consequences which we can study in the lab and with empirical data. They give us predictable sources of variation so we can build a model of what we think is going on and offer tools for intervention. I won't have time to talk about this, but this is basically a sort of scheme of what's going on. Ideally, you have a novel security threat and you adapt to it, but what happens is you have all these biases intervening, and these lead to disaster, which is going to be not so bad or particularly bad, depending on certain other criteria, like whether your state is undemocratic or powerful and so on. I won't get into those, we don't have time. And I'll skip this slide and just summarise. So I think there is a history of very poor adaptation to security threats, probably in many other domains as well. It is a sort of common pattern. It does appear to be at least partly rooted in human social psychology. And this evolutionary approach, this natural security approach, which we discussed it, in this working group and then presented in this book, at least offers a way of thinking and drawing together a framework for tying all these different elements together, tools for exploring the process of adaptation, and ultimately, potentially, lessons for how to improve our own adaptation. Lessons from 3.5 billion years of life on Earth. Thank you.
Okay. We had almost a perfect storm here. The audio cable was bad, the video cable was bad, and the laptop was bad. We now have a new cable, a new cable, and a new laptop. If somebody wants to project slides, I suggest you put them on the machine in advance, because the rule which Ross asked me to enforce is that laptop futzing time comes out of your 10 minutes. Do you want to ask a question?
I did. First of all, I would refer to earlier work by Pease et al. With respect to people not expecting the Spanish Inquisition. One thing you did address in your talk is that with all of these threats, there are 100 random things that could happen at any time. You could say we didn't expect someone, you know, running a plane into nuclear installations, or that. But you can't expect all of them at any given time. So any time one of these things is going to happen, there's going to be a rush from the public. Well, why wasn't it on the news the night before this happened that this could potentially have happened? We did it. You know, Pearl Harbor, we did have, you know, some boats there. We did think we might need a military presence that might go out to Japan. What is is there more evidence that these things are really unexpected and that we're somehow, I'm finding it a bit difficult to believe that we should ever be able to reach a point where we're be able to expect whatever
right,
happens
absolutely.
Tomorrow.
Completely agree with you. So, I mean, I tried to sort of flesh out the examples in the chapter a little with a bit more detail and some of the literature, but absolutely, we're never going to be able to predict unexpected threats. And in fact, paleontologists on our team, Girard from Age, his key thing was that the problem is actually unpredictability. Adaptation, well, okay, you can adapt to things if they're relatively predictable, but as soon as you have a rare, unexpected event, which is beyond the lifetime of a single organism, it becomes extremely difficult to prepare, but you can't prepare for that. So the thing that seems to be interesting is the kinds of adaptations which help you on an everyday basis, but also serve a dual purpose in protecting you against those other unexpected disasters as well. So for one example, he says redundancy. If you build in redundancy to the system, it helps you in everyday tasks, but it also bolsters you against unexpected things as well. There's a lot of issues there, but that's one of the way this one.
So I'm going to stick with the theory that we'll do the talks in order and then have a collective discussion at the end.
Yeah, I think that's best.
So let's try that. So our last speaker, I think I don't know if I missed anybody else, is Jeff Hancock. Right. Who says he's just going to talk?
I'll just talk, because why not? I was inspired. So my name is Jeff Hancock. I'm from Cornell University. I'm a psychologist that studies interpersonal deception rather than, say, security-based deception. So I'm really interested in how the way we lie to each other intersects with the communication technologies that we all use and have in our pocket or you're looking at right now. And I'm interested in two parts. How is it that technology changes the way we lie or shapes the way we lie? And the second is, can technology be used to sort of facilitate detection? And me personally, the shaping and how people lie is really most interesting, but people tend to fund detection, so I do that as well, I guess. With the shaping, I've been thinking about it over the last couple of years. I think there's three sort of things about the way technology affects the way we lie to each other on a day-to-day basis. The first are goals. We all lie typically for a reason. There's a very small percentage of us that lie for fun. Most of us lie for a reason. We looked at online dating as one example of that. We find that men lie about how tall they are, and women lie about how much they weigh. And this depressingly fits like every other study done on online dating back to newspapers, and is consistent with really old social psychological goals or evolutionary goals. So even though we have all this new technology, these very old goals still drive our deception. The social technical sort of properties of different media affect deception. So if you go into a chat room, as an example, you will talk to somebody who is different than who they actually say they are. This kind of identity deception is very common, but we're finding in social networking sites that people are ridiculously honest. And we've been looking at sort of why. So one experiment we looked at was LinkedIn, which is a sort of online resume thing in which you link to other people in your network. And we did an experiment where we had people create actual resumes, and they were led to believe that they would be on LinkedIn, linked with their social network, or they would be produced privately, and only we in the lab would be looking at them. And so these are sort of traditional resumes. They were done on paper and everything. And the LinkedIn resumes were much more honest. There were less lies. The lies that were told were smaller in magnitude. And the lies that they did tell were more about interests, like whether they sail a lot or not. And this is because they're thinking about their social network, their audience. So these sort of social technical affordances or features can affect lying. In chat rooms, you're rather anonymous, so people engage in identity play and these sort of deceptions. In social networking sites, you're constrained by the property linking you to your social network. And the last, I guess actually that I would say is more of an example of a warrant, this idea that Joe Walther and Malcolm Parks introduced, that when we're online, there are things that connect us to who we are in the real world, and social networks are a great example of a warrant that connects who we are online with our identity, our real world identity. Last, we see with these social technical features, records. So one of the things that's probably the the biggest impact on deception is how everything that we're putting online now is like a digital tattoo. It's possible to get rid of them, but it's sort of difficult, and they can last for a long time. So when people put things up on Facebook or they write an email, that's going to last a lot longer than this talk, for instance, although I guess it is being recorded, or a phone call I have or a whispered conversation. I can't tell you how many times a week I open up the news and I see something about Facebook catching somebody out or an email. Almost every major scandal in the last 5 or 6 years has involved email, where somebody was caught in a lie. In Canada, there was a guy that was suing because his social life was ruined in a car accident because his neck hurt. And the prosecution went onto his Facebook site and showed him drinking, smoking dope, playing pool, all this stuff over the last 3 or 4 months, and he lost the suit. So there's this recordability feature that affects lying. So I think goals and warrants and the features of the technology can shape the way we lie. It's not like lying's going to go away. We're just going to change or morph how we lie. On the other side, everything is becoming textual. Right now, my phone service, when I receive a message for 25 cents, it converts it to text and sends it to me in my email. And I think that this is just going to increase. More and more communication is going to be textual, and the ones that aren't immediately textual, like email, will be converted. And this does a couple of things. First, it leaves a trace of all of our language. And the second development is the computational advances in natural language processing and statistical classification. We can now process really large amounts of text really, really fast. And so my background's actually in language, psychology of language, and what I was interested in is when we do actually lie in some of these media, are there any linguistic traces of deception in, say, an email or an instant message? So we run a number of experiments. We also love to find natural corpora in which there are messages that were deceptive and messages that were truthful. And we then use word searching, parsing, natural language processing tools of various kind to say, here's what the features are in these deceptive ones, here's what they are in the truthful ones, are there any differences? So I'm going to tell you about one. It's really simple to talk about, although lots of NLP stuff is not simple, and that's first person singular, the word I or me, not we, but I or me. When people lie, they engage in psychological distancing, so they sort of distance themselves from the deception. And this is easily sort of countered by the use of first-person singular. And although there is no silver bullet in deception, it's shocking how many times this first-person singular finding occurs. So first-person singular goes down when people lie. We see that in our experiments in the lab in synchronous environments, like I am, or in email. We've seen it in perjury statements, in court testimony, in our online dating sample. The more people lied about their height and weight and age, the fewer times they used I in the About Me section. We've also looked at the Bush administration statements about Iraq. A journalism outfit counted and identified every time they said something demonstrably false, according to the 9/11 Commission, so weapons of mass destruction, links to Al-Qaeda. And there were 535 of these statements, and we compared them to other statements made on the same day that were not false about Iraq. And we can then look and see if, they should be the exact same if the belief state, and we'll have to talk more about beliefs and things, clearly. If the belief state was that we really believed them to be deceptive, then they should talk very similarly, and I'll just continue with first person singular. That if they believe the false things, then they should be the same in terms of first-person singular when they talk about things that turned out to be true. That would be a case of mistakes. They were mistaken. If they were deceptive and they actually kind of had an idea that perhaps there weren't these links or weapons of mass destruction, then first-person singular, as one example, would decrease. And so we ran the analysis, and I've been doing research for about 15 years now, and we got an effect size that was so large, I actually had to go back and look at it because I didn't think you could have an effect size over 1, a D equals 1. And it turns out that just means it's a really large effect size. This is the biggest change, and we looked at all of the main features of language that our models have been developing, so negative emotion, causal terms, cognitive complexity terms, etc. On every single dimension, the language of the false statements matched a deceptive model. So the idea here, and the reason I mention this political one in this context, is some people sometimes argue, well, if people know that you're going to be looking at their language, then surely they can control this sort of thing. Well, politicians are sort of our view of the future. In the future, probably everything we say and do will be recorded. And politicians already know this, and if we can see these sort of patterns in politicians' speech where they know they're being recorded, then it's possible that these patterns, and probable actually, are non-conscious and extremely difficult to control. So there may be a future there. Who knows? It'll be interesting to find out. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now let's see if we can have a conversation. Because part of what we're doing here is getting to know each other, let's try asking people just to state your name. So I'll start with probably where we'll go back.
Peter Hyman. Are you going around first?
Just say your name before you talk.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of comments. One, the idea that the Cheney-Bush link of Saddam and 9/11 was not deception seems to me to be a stretch. That certainly sounds like deception. But I wanted to introduce the notion of constructive disinformation, which is also deception. The fact that the British intelligence had figured out that the Germans were going to bomb Coventry,
right,
but didn't want to let anybody know and let them bomb Coventry because they had broken the
enigma,
code,
right,
is a clear case of deception, mm-hmm, but it's a very different kind of deception, mm-hmm, because it has serious consequences.
Right.
The other comment I wanted to make is that when we do this adaptation, as you call it, after risks have occurred, when we have failed to see what the consequences might be, the immediate response to 9/11 was to ban plastic knives on airplanes. And I think this is symptomatic of the sort of palliative solutions, some of the airport security, for example. It's intended to give the appearance, in fact, you take your shoes off after one incident. It's the appearance of doing something constructive rather than actually doing something that might have prevented something. And that is in itself a deception, right? So there's a serious problem. But I think the problem is that there are too many factors, political, economic, whatever, don't want to scare the populace kinds of problems. And in the case of 9/11, they had memos that said this is going to happen, basically. And my own personal connection was this. I worked with Alex Blumenthal around the corner at the Department of Transportation 15 years ago on mapping out all of the risks in aviation safety and security. And he's written 13 or 14 reports over the years outlining all of this stuff. And the answer is, hey, we can't deal with this because it's too improbable. And this is sort of the argument that we have all these insecure operating systems and we can't deal with anything, so we're just going to pretend that everything is secure. It seems to me that we need a much more proactive approach to all of this. Thank you.
Anybody on the panel want to respond?
Well, I'll just say quickly that the idea of the enigma deception is an important one. If anybody has any other thoughts of historical deceptions, we're really eager to find places where history has shown a leader or administration to be deceptive. So.
Yeah, John Mueller, Ohio State. For Frank, are there studies basically as how much money scam artists make, and is it more or less than they could make doing working at McDonald's?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just your case of the guy on the beach. Basically, what happens? He made 50 pounds. He has to share it with four people. So about that much time, they can make more money working at McDonald's. Their game's probably closed down. That guy's going to be looking for them forever, trying to figure it out. They can't do it on the same day in the same beach. So it's basically been, they haven't any money, essentially.
Well,
I've got some. Yeah. There's got to be no risk of being thrown in the slam.
The fact that they keep doing it all the time and all over the world means that obviously they are making enough money. Well, it depends where you go and look, I guess.
You ever see the Blue Brothers? Good movie. Yeah, that's right. They send the movies all the time.
So, Alan Friedman, Harvard University. I want to follow up on a conversation that Stuart and Dominic had about the adaptive nature of redundancy. Because it seems to me that absent threats, redundancy is disadvantageous from an evolutionary perspective. We see this with organizations and risk management, finance, and like that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about that, and maybe everyone else on the panel has some things. And also, resiliency, is resiliency evolutionarily advantageous absent a present threat?
Right. Well, so redundancy is expensive. You have to replicate things. So without any other, all else equal, you want to get rid of redundancy. This insight came from this paleontologist's analysis of which types of species had come through the mass extinctions, and it turned out that the ones that had built-in redundancy were more likely to survive catastrophic, unpredictable events. So it is costly, and that is perhaps why it's relatively rare. I mean, nature is very efficient. But some organisms do need redundancy in their everyday lives if they incur damage or some other sort of quotidian problem. So yeah, there's definitely two sides to it. Resiliency is something we talked a lot about. And again, it seems very important. The UK actually set up something called the Resiliency, what was it called, Terry? Resiliency Council or something, which was to do with dealing with not only terrorists, but pandemic threats and that kind of thing, and it was specifically to try and work out not just how would you respond, but how would you respond in a way that maximise your capacity and, over an extended period of time, that kind of thing. I don't have a good answer to that other than that I agree resiliency is very important. I'm not quite sure how to define it. So.
I'm just out with Microsoft. Thinking about what you were saying, Dominique, about adaptation happens after disasters. Are there examples of major policy changes? And I'm scratching my head, and what I come up with is the Crusades, where there wasn't a disaster, but there was a major policy action.
Right.
And maybe it would be interesting to look there for future examples.
Yeah. So, one of the reviewers on the chapter sort of challenged me to you know, think of the counterexample. I couldn't come up with many, I have to say. One thing that people often say is the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, a huge disaster. But it depends on which perspective you take. You know, it's a disaster for the USSR, but you know, major bonus for the West, perhaps. So I'm sort of waffling because I don't have other good counterexamples. I should, having thought about this so long. And either it's because I haven't thought hard enough or well enough about it. But I do have a sense that there's many examples of adaptation failure, not very many examples of adaptation success. But then the failures stand out more, right? So,
exactly.
You know, maybe MIT is brilliantly adapting all the time to student needs or something. We can never complain. you just don't notice great the things that go well.
Sorry,
got
canceled.
I mean, the question is, can you interpret some of this lack of adaptation as yet another example of people's inability to do probability estimation? So I have some low probability event something might happen over and somewhere over a long period of time versus other things that I know are going to happen, and I simply prioritize the definite things over the diffuse thing. So my favorite example is I moved to California in 1999, and being a good person, I decided to go over to move my house because pretty much it's near certainty that there will be a major earthquake in California, right? And I tried to buy earthquake proofing equipment. And every time I went to a hardware store, you could find one small collection of earthquake proofing equipment hidden in the back corner where no one could find it. And up in the front, you would find 1999, you know, the year Y2K problem prep stuff, which was marginally the same stuff as earthquake preparation. You don't have to bolt your furniture to the wall, but you do have to buy water and spare food and emergency blankets and all that stuff. But basically, because people could predict, you know, Y2K and they were afraid of it, they were willing to do something about it. But this actual, much more likely, but much more diffuse threat was something that everybody kind of discounted and didn't think about. And I only thought about it because I just moved to the area. So for me, it was a new and more discreet threat.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that increases salience for you.
Yeah, exactly.
You move there, it's a difference. I think we see that example all the time. That's I think it's very common. And earthquake insurance, the take rate goes up after earthquake, which is actually when the risk goes down. Mm-hmm. If you look at the math, I mean, it's completely opposite effect.
You also mentioned, say, I mean, Bruce mentioned Kahneman Tversky stuff on prospect theory. There is a reversal of people's perception of probability. So very low probability events, people overestimate them.
Right.
So, but I think it comes down to salience in psychology that people are very much moved by dramatic events which seem scary and make the news.
Andrew Adams, University of Reading. A question for Dominic and a question for Jack. For Dominic, one thing I think was missing from your list of psychological elements there was gain-seeking individuals who have a sociopathic element. And I think that's a major issue. We've been talking, for instance, about the attitude of the Bush regime to the war on terror and using it for another policy goal. That could be seen as a sociopathic response because it wasn't the major threat, it was what they wanted to do anyway, and using it as an excuse. So I think that there's another element there that needs to be added into this. And for Jeff, the analysis that you've got in there is for English, and I was struck very much by the one you used, which is the use of the singular first-person pronoun. In my studies in Japanese, mm-hmm. because in Japanese you don't have pronouns coming up very often. So have there been any studies on this in other languages than English, and if so, what's the different cues that you come up with?
Right, it's just beginning. It's very Western and English-centric. So we've started looking at Arabic a little bit, and it has a really cool aspect of language called obligatory evidentiality, which is the idea that they can't just say it's raining out. They need to specify how they know that. And so we've started to look at that. It's more difficult to parse, obviously, than I. I haven't looked at Japanese or sort of the high-context languages yet, but there are differences. So, for instance, in more collectivist cultures, they find pro-social line quite positive and non-problematic, whereas here we're supposed to tell you if your haircut looks bad or whatever. So, but in Japan, different.
Your haircut's great, by the way.
Thanks, man.
I've been discriminating against the back of the room because I was going to the front of it, so let's just jump back over here. Yeah.
Lee Church, Cambridge University.
Bruce.
I was struck by a similarity between what you said about the fixation on point events and a fairly influential work in kind of 1990s HCI, which said that the reason the AI-like worlds weren't working building things was they were ignoring the everyday background experience of the users of technology. And really this everyday background experience is the kind of dominant force when we interact with a computer. So I've been wondering whether the same analogy might apply between the way we think about people's interaction with security systems, that the reason why people don't do as security professionals would expect them is because we fixate on major vulnerability events rather than the everyday experience. And that might give an interesting correlate to Ross's work on economics modeling of end users showing that some of the behavior is reasonable.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, there's sort of a couple of ways we see that. And I'm sure other people next 2 days are going to talk about how users sort of respond to security warnings as background nonsense, because it is background nonsense. And for us, it's a big deal, but most of the time they click OK and I don't care, and actually it is OK, and they don't care. And the problem is, like the hustles we saw, the one time you do care is the one time you forget that you care. And it always seems that the attacker has an advantage because he picks the time and place of the attack, and the defender has to sort of be background aware of the possibility of the attack 24/7, which is fundamentally impossible. I mean, you know, that jewelry store owner is, you know, I mean, you know, her lifetime of experience is you interact with some police badge and they're the police and it's fine. So she's probably engaged in some reasonable behavior. But because the attacker chose that and preys on that, it's wrong. I think this is sort of a fundamental problem we have in security, and there's no easy way to solve it. Social engineering works because we're, you know, as fundamentally nice people, and most of the time, it's honest. You hold the door for somebody to go into the building, and they deserve to go in the building, and nothing happens. So yeah, I think that is all very important.
Yeah, if I may add to that, this principle that we were trying to extract from these scans, the first one about distraction, is one where you have someone who's focused on a task and they don't give a damn about anything else. And it's a very tight connection between this and the security and usability trade-off, of course, because you have, there's another example I put in the paper, which comes from Frank Abagnale, who's the guy who was portrayed by Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can. And he said, he's now a reformed and security consultant, he says he was going to visit a computer company, or actually a company whose computers were being fixed for the Y2K problem, and they had this bunch of programmers everywhere hacking at these computers, trying to fix the code that might break. And says, where do these guys come from? I didn't know you had so many programmers. Oh, we hired these guys from India. They're really smart, and they're really sharp and on the ball with computers, and they're so cheap. And they were, he said, yeah, right. So how do you know that they're not going to insert Trojan horses or backdoors and so on into your computer system? You just know them because of their price tag. And there's so many other companies in India and so on that could be doing whatever to your computer. But they were only focused on fixing Y2K, not on their security issue.
Hi, Joseph Pinnell from the University of Cambridge. I had a question for Dominic. I thought your theory that sort of we gradually get off where we should be in terms of security, and then we need some huge event to jump back to sort of the right level of security. It reminds me of control theory, and I wonder if we don't actually appropriately go to where we should in security, but we consistently overshoot and have too strong of a reaction, which would be an underdamped system in control theory. So you overshoot, and then if you're really underdamped, you sort of undershoot again and oscillate a few times. So I was wondering if you've sort of looked at, is that a characteristic pattern in these historic cases that you've analyzed?
Yeah, that's a nice idea. The one example is a little different. It's to do with expectations of Arab-Israeli wars. So Israelis were very afraid before 67, and after 67 happened, they won a fantastic victory. They suddenly became extremely overconfident to the extent to which they could not contemplate the possibility they'd be attacked again. And 73 happened, and even though they did pretty well, as a result of that great expectation, they perceived themselves to have done badly. So definitely oscillation. In terms of sort of security, I'm not sure, but John Miller, I think, is here, and he'll talk at this conference about overreacting to threats like 9/11. I think there's good evidence that that has happened.
Terry Taylor. I just wanted to really ask the liars and deceivers to look at it. Presumably you've looked at it from the opposite direction in terms of the importance, if we look back in evolutionary terms, of the importance of trust. So I'm looking at the opposite of lying and deception, but building trust and the link between that and ideology and religion, which in human behavior has been supremely important. And you could argue that if you think about religion in terms of societal cohesiveness, is amazingly persistent and it's obviously a part of our evolutionary output. But so that's one point. The other thing is perhaps about the economics of redundancy as an answer to survival against the unexpected catastrophic event. And when one looks back, there are marvelous examples. Probably Chicago's is probably a marked one, whereby they live underground for 3, 7, and 13, and here the actual year is incorrect. But there is a species that's developed a strategy. I don't want to give them a single brain, but there is a strategy for survival that perhaps on the surface there are events that wipe out a whole range of species. So I think, I don't know who's, I know that Yerat Vermeer has done some work on the economics of redundancy. It's within the body and it's also societal as well as a group, you know, two kidneys and so on.
There are a couple of people in the room.
Question for Bruce. You spoke about what happens after an earthquake I had an opposite experience. I wonder, yesterday, and I'm wondering if you predict that I will now be more vulnerable to fraudsters. In the taxi from the airport, I left my London Freedom Pass, which is immensely valuable. And 2 hours later, the driver left it, came back and left it at reception. Didn't leave a name, I couldn't find it. It certainly improved my view of the honesty of the citizens of Boston. The other nice thing he did for me, the receipt he left blank for me to fill in.
Yeah, that's a common thing. Though.
Yeah, that is common for you.
I have a question for that.
Remember names.
Rachel Grainstead. I was thinking, you know, a lot of the examples that you made were actually, you know, if you think about either with written communication, profiles, prepared remarks. I wonder if you compare sort of off-the-cuff communication line, is it, are these indicators, you'd expect them to be stronger when people are not necessarily having a chance to sort of craft their story. Are they stronger or less stronger?
Right. Well, the patterns, I can give you two examples. The patterns with the Bush administration, sometimes they're speaking in remarks, they're responding in a news conference, and the pattern is strongest there. When they're giving a prepared speech, like State of the Union, it disappears quite a bit. Some of the dimensions remain, but many others are wiped out. With online dating, things like first-person singular remain, but other features like typically you'll see negative emotion words associated with deception. The opposite happens in online dating profiles. So people that are more deceptive, they tend to talk more positively. If they're deceptive about, say, their job, they'll talk a little bit more about money. So there does seem to be, when you're in an asynchronous environment, some strategies that you can employ. And when we ask people to try and detect deception, there's a motivation enhancement effect. So more motivated liars online do better than highly motivated liars face-to-face. Face-to-face, highly motivated liars have a motivation impairment effect, so they tend to give off more cues. In online space, motivated liars seem to be able to take advantage of that asynchronicity, the editability and the planning time. So I do think it matters. Yeah.
I actually think it's like, you know, I'm sort of have a slight sense of unease that basically it's not really that easy to surgically focus and say, like, this is what's happening, it's this one pattern, it's deception. I mean, I know this because of the dating studies, we've done some of this ourselves, right? And what it actually is, it's not intentional deception, it's actually social control mechanisms are a lot stronger, have more influence on people when they enter this information into the system. So they're basically more putting in stuff like what they think, you know, the images that they should be corresponding to, and they've put in the image, you know, that they're looking for. It's quite interesting. If you speak to people about it, and if you look at what they're doing, effectively what they're actually, and it's that, it's the effect that it's public, and it's also that they would actually pick certain people as okay people out if they met them face to face in an environment. Because then they have a chance to basically balance the various factors that are important to them and that overall make up this image of it against it. Whereas when you basically have to say, you know, 5 foot 8, 5 foot 10, you know, there's a hard line, you put it in and they don't realize they're actually reducing the pool of potentially eligible people by about 80% by doing this. But once you speak to them about it and they start to realize that, they actually start to adapt, you know, or through experience, they go wild through these data, they change their behavior. So
right.
I think it's a bit more complex than that. I'd be reluctant to just call it deception. Would you agree?
I think that you make some good points. I think it is fair to call some of what we were looking at deception. In fact, when we asked them to identify deceptive elements in their profile, because we were interested in can people be truthful to us about their deception? So this is the problem with self-report. And actually, their self-report really correlated with what we were defining as deception is one thing. But you're right. We've been starting to think of online dating profiles, even social network profiles, as promises. It's sort of a promise of what I will be like, and so we see people drawing on, you know, well, I don't weigh that right now, but I will diet to get to that point. And so this promise is really about, you know, their potential and what they could be like realistically. So that I agree with you, but I still think that deception is a real and fair issue.
Last comment
before
we
get
started.
Dan Boyd, Microsoft Research. I just want to bounce off of this, and there's another
relative symbol and relative mechanism. So I was doing analysis years ago about Craigslist. I am a quiet, clean roommate. Compared to the frat that I just moved out, one of this really interesting challenges is when people's perceptions of what they're performing match what their expectations of the norms are versus what an external viewer's expectations of the norms are. And I think you get another interesting twitch, and I think 5'10", 5'11", is a different game
right.
than a lot of the sort of qualitative descriptors where you're trying to identify yourself in a pool of people. And this comes out again in some of the social network sites when you see people trying to describe their music tastes, right? Well, okay, I'm not necessarily deceiving because what the heck is my favorite taste? And do I sit there saying, oh, well, I'm listening to this one song the most frequently, do I do it based on a behavioral? Do I do it based on what I think is actually coming to mind at the beginning of it? How do I actually mark this? And when you return back material like Last.fm, analysis that says this is your behavioral favorite, you're like, no, that's not right, I don't agree with it at all. So you get this really interesting perception of a lot of the more descriptive stuff.
Yeah.
Sort of even messes with a lot of
this. Yeah. Well, I think actually some of David's point about defining deception raised a lot of these sort of conceptual issues. So for instance, if everybody thinks that, if all the guys think, well, if I just do a strong roundup by an inch, and if everybody's doing that, right, is that deceptive if this is the norm in what they perceive for that community? And then all those issues, those issues.
I would add we need to include self-deception in the mix here. I don't think we can go very far with deception unless we account for self-deception. And we can't have a decent notion of deception unless it covers cases of self-deception.
Okay, thank you. Before we take a break, I want to say two things, and Bruce wants to say something. If you look around the room, you will realize that there are N seats in the room and there are greater than N people in the room because there are people up here and the two poor people who have been relegated to the floor. What this means is that when you come up for the next panel, you have to abandon your seat completely. Don't leave your muffins and your power cord there because somebody here is going to go sit in your seat. When you go back, you're going to sit in some other seats. It's the way to mix everybody up, right? So during the break, abandon your seat, come up here, prepare yourself for the panel, and then leave space for these people to sit. Second, we do now have a working laptop over there. If you want to project from your own laptop, I suggest you come try it in advance. If you want to come project from that laptop, why don't you put your slides on it during the break and you have a full half hour. Now, sir.
And we actually do that on purpose to force you guys to mix with each other. The announcement I have is at the end of the break, the food out there will be given to ravenous grad students. So if you want something, please grab it now. There will, of course, be lunch.
There is one other announcement. We are putting together session chairs as we go along. Does anyone want to volunteer to be session chair for the second session?
The requirements are have a watch with a second hand and willing to be nasty.
Brutal. Volunteer this man. thank you.
Do you have a maple on the picture?